Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items that you may not know about, but should.
Folks, welcome back to Guitar Radio Show. Our next guest is honestly the essence of why I do this show. This is somebody who's done it all, seen it all. Songwriter, guitar player, touring musician, studio musician. He's done it all. And now he's got a new chapter. This next chapter is he is written a song and put together the formation of something called Rogue Warrior Music. The new track is called Something Worth Fighting For, which is something that really hits home to me, as I have a 91-year-old dad who's a veteran of the Korean War. And I have lots and lots of friends who are veterans who are not looked after in the way they should be. And with this song and this project, he's hoping to raise awareness. But we're going to talk about that and so much more about his career and his gear and his ripping guitar playing as well. Folks, please welcome the Guitar Radio Show, Mr. Billy Crane. How are you, sir?
Hey, I'm doing great, Mark. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thanks for being here.
Oh, I love being here. It's just an honor, complete honor.
Well, thank you. So, you know, I was telling you off mic that, you know, I'm familiar with your record called Village that you put out in 2022. I particularly like the tune Honeycomb.
Yes. Tinges of AC/DC, of Angus.
Totally. Totally.
Of course, I didn't have my hand raised up in the air when.
And you probably weren't wearing a schoolboy's outfit neither.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. did you see recently? His guitar tech, I guess, sent out a it was on Facebook somewhere. He did a walkthrough interview with his rig and everything, videoed it. And you know, guy carries, I'm sure you know all this, 14 Marshalls, you know, on the road. And he's got a one tech guy that his whole job is to fix each Marshall each night that blows up. So that was amazing to me.
I mean, yeah, but you know, well, somebody of that stature, you know, it's so funny too, because he doesn't over distort anything. It's just raw power coming through there.
Yeah, it is. That's just what his tone, man, the essence of it, you know. It does. It's not that usual Marshall grind.
Right.
It's got, man, just sustain and just beauty to it.
Right. Well, I always say this a lot because it always stuck in my head when he told me what Billy Gibbons said, it's meat on metal on wood.
Oh, that's awesome.
Right?
That's awesome.
Yeah. That stuck in my head big time.
Meat on metal on wood. I got to remember that. Yeah.
So tell me, walk me through this project that you have going here with the new foundation, Rogue Warrior Music.
Okay, I started about 6 years ago. I got a call from a guy, a veteran down in Chattanooga. They have a musician's thing down there called Sound Cores, and it's got Tennessee musicians listed all over it. And he went through this list of 12,000 people and saw a picture of me and read about me and called me and said, look, we have an organization down here. Would you like to come and visit what we do? And I said, sure. And I went down to Chattanooga, and there was two songwriters from Pierre Nashville, two Top Gun guys, Steve Dean and Don Goodman. And they were in a room full of about 30 vets. And what their concept was, they would take a vet, get a veteran, they would put them on, they called the hot seat, when one felt like telling a story, and they would get them to tell their story. Now, that's the trick, is a lot of these veterans, go back to the top, these veterans all had PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd all they all had different stories. You know, some had been in combat. A lot of them hadn't even been in combat. And I'll tell the story about one in a minute. But getting them to tell their story is the hardest part, because it's, you know, been eating them inside for so long that a lot of them break down crying or just, you know, into a very, very nervous fits and stuff. But if you could get them to tell these stories, these professional songwriters would sit down and write with them their story. A lot of them are about a combat they've been through or about losing their best friend in combat. Sometimes they would write about their family back home because they're so affected too. Then we would take this song and we would go into the studio and record it and make a CD out of it and put it out. And I have seen miracles happen of men and women that were just complete broken down souls do a complete turnaround of become productive members of society who then they start helping other vets. So I did that for almost six years, and my health has gotten worse later, and I've been trying in Chattanooga, and I couldn't see good at night, so I've decided to do one out of here right below Nashville. They've got one in Nashville, Cooperation Song, and I'm going to have Rogue Warrior Music here. And so it's therapeutic songwriting is basically what it is.
So is this like, I mean, because I know that we have it here in Austin, and it's all over the country too, is sort of like Guitars for Vets. You familiar with that?
Yeah, that's right. That's a Gibson thing, right?
I believe so.
I think so. I think somebody told me, but yeah, they give away like 1,000 or 2,000 guitars a year or something
like that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. But to see there, still you have the problem of you're not getting to the root of the problem,
right?
Of the vet, and it's in their story. And once their story is known, it gives them a sense of belonging, because these men and women have been through. I mean, I've heard, golly, one of my first ventures was with a guy who bought a camera to take over to a rock to take pictures in his first day there in Desert Storm. His first day there was spent 14 hours picking up body parts, and he had this camera with all these pictures, and he could never develop them. They sat on his dresser for 10 years after he came back. And after we got in there, we wrote a song called I Have a Camera. And it's all about this thing. And he ended up, he sent us a letter. Finally, afterwards, he ended up taking the camera to the shop and having to remove the pictures. And he used the pictures for, he got married at his wedding. So it was a beautiful ending to this horrendous story that this guy told. So they need to tell their story, because they come back here. The people, you know how American people are. They call them baby killers and everything else. There's no respect there. They're just doing what they've been taught to do at their job, you know.
Right.
And war is ugly. We all know that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it continues to happen as we speak.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it always will, and it always has been.
Yeah. There's the lyric on the whole song of Something Worth Fighting For is incredibly poignant and really just hit me hard. As I was telling you off mic earlier, I teach adult ed here in Austin, and one of the classes we talk about is communication and understanding, and I always mention that, and it was wild that you had the line in there about 25 men and women every day are taking their lives because of the PTSD, and that, you know, the folks that are taking care of them, so to speak, are just pumping them full of drugs and not dealing with the problem at hand, like you were mentioning. And I was saying, I was saying to you off mic as well, saying, it's 25 a day, which is probably more, as you said. And but at the end of a week, that's enough for a jet airplane. a commercial airliner. And, you know, people don't say boo, but if a commercial airliner were to crash every week on schedule, the world would be in a rage.
Oh, you know it. You know it. And actually, when I rewrote this song, we had written another one called Hey America 2 years ago, and it said 22 a day. Now, fast forward 2 years to now, I had rewritten I wrote something worth fighting for him because it had jumped to 25.
Right.
And that's in a 2 year span, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just, it's frightening.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And, you know, and I appreciate your mission, you know, what you're trying to do as far as, you know, get people to realize. And you were telling me earlier that, you know, some folks, you were wondering if they're actually listening to the lyrics and getting the message.
Yeah, it is, because I've had so many people say, God, song, what a great song, it sounds great. But then they don't talk about the message. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, they'll give me, or thanks for helping the veterans. Well, you know, the thing is, what can you do about it? What can you, you know, how can you help? And by getting involved, you know, and trying to get this, what I'm trying to do is get people involved and helping them,
right,
get on their feet. I mean, it's not an easy thing.
Right.
You're dealing with the U.S. government, you know, the Vet Center, and boy, oh boy, talking about red tape. Yeah, you know about the bureaucracy behind that.
Yep. Folks, you all heard the song on the way in. I invite you to go back and listen to it again, or you can go to Billy's YouTube page.
Yes.
You can go to iTunes or anywhere you stream music and hear the song.
Yes.
Now, let me ask you this. And also, if you go to the show notes at guitarradioshow.com for this episode, you'll find a link to the YouTube and to the context, the interviews with some of the veterans, which are really, really great. So where can people go if they want to get involved, if they want to learn more and they want to do something?
There's so many different agencies. Well, like you said, Guitars for Vets.
Yep.
You can contact them. There is Charlie Daniels Journey Home Project.
Mm-hmm.
Just about every city has some kind of vet program that you can get involved with. You can call any vet center in any town, and see where they need help. I mean, with me personally, if you're in the Nashville area, you can contact me, and I have a group starting up in February. There's one in Nashville called Operation Song. Also, there's so many different opportunities.
Yeah.
That you can do. You just got to reach out and do it.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing is finding the vets. Once you can find them and get them out, or just befriend a vet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they need somebody to talk to, mm-hmm, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody to listen to them and listen to their story. I tell you, it changes their whole outlook.
Oh, yeah. And in my classes that I teach, let's see, it's a class somewhere between 25 to 28 people in the class, and at least 8 to 10 of them are vets.
Wow, that's so awesome.
Yeah, and it's always interesting because, you know, if they're willing to share with the rest of the folk in the room, it's always great for them, for everybody else, the we'll call them the layperson, to hear and to understand. Because so many times, I mean, you know, folks who didn't serve and folks that you know, just everyday things, everybody thinks, you know, everybody's got their own journey and everybody's got their own story and everybody's got their own struggles. But to walk a mile in somebody else's shoes and to really understand, wow, my problems ain't so bad when I hear something like this.
Absolutely. You know, I get thanked so much for drive down to Chattanooga every other week, and I, you know, they would be thanking me, I tell you what, it works both ways.
Right.
They did way more for me than I ever did for them.
Right.
They've changed my life and the way I've looked at things, and it's that blessing of giving, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Now I know you've got a busy 2024 coming up, because you're gonna have two releases for the year.
I hope so. That might be three.
Oh my goodness.
I can just get through the Christmas holidays.
So when's the record for this project coming out, the entire album?
I have one coming out probably in a month out of Chattanooga, and it's the original record I'd start in Chattanooga. It will be called Hey America. Okay. And it's coming out, I think, in January.
Okay.
Then I'm working on a new one called Hoodie.
Right.
That's the title cut. It's actually about I have two adopted children, one 11, and she'd kill me when she said 8, 11 and 14. And if you ever notice, every kid in America is walking around with they've got their hoodie on and their shoulders hunched over and their cell phone in their pocket.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the title cut of this record. It's about them. I'm working on that. I've got a band, a duo actually out of Birmingham with a guy named Jay Willoughby, called the Willbillies, and we're doing a reunion CD. We had a deal back in Nashville back in the 90s that never went anywhere, but we're working on that record. So, and I think I got one more, and I can't remember what it is.
Wow, you are really busy. It's kind of wild. I mean, the thing that I noticed about you with all your stuff and the other songs that you, I mean, we're going to get into this in just a second, some of the other songs that you've written for other folks who've taken those songs and gone on to have a lot of success with those songs, is your songs are really, you're very thoughtful lyricist, and you're very, you're a watcher, you're an observer, and you take it all in, and then it all comes out in this story. Have you always been that way, you think?
No, you know, I went through so many different phases of songwriting. You know, when I first started writing was when I was 15, and I was in a band with, I know you're familiar with my brother Tommy, who
mm-hmm.
Was in the Charlie Daniels band in the heyday from 75 through 88.
Right.
And we had a band together that was starting out, and of course, that back in the Dwayne and Dickie era, when Dwayne was still, Allman was still alive. And so I started writing these blues songs like the Allman Brothers Band, because that's who I wanted to be like.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was out, it's funny, you're down in Austin, I played the old Armadillo.
Oh my goodness.
Years ago with Bobby Whitlock. Remember Bobby from Derek and the Dominoes?
Oh yeah.
So I spent a year on the road with him, you know, and learned a lot of cool stuff from him. He was a great guy. And then I went right into the Henry Paul Band, and Henry had just come out of the Outlaws.
Right.
So we were writing these Southern rock songs and different kind of rock songs at that point. Coming out of that, I went into the Bellamy Brothers on the road with them for 5 years. So I started writing country songs, and I mm-hmm. had my first top five country hit with those guys, and progressed and moved back to Nashville in 1988 and started writing UMG publishing down. Well, back then it was. Can't remember, Universal, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And started writing staff songs. Now that was a beast, because what you're doing is you're trying to write a hit song. Okay.
Right.
So you're out there And you're usually chasing your tail because you're okay, here's what's on the radio you hear right now.
Right.
Okay, this is what I need to write. Well, by the time you write that song, radio's already changed.
Yeah.
And so once I got out of that in 2011, when my brother passed away, I was playing guitar. I was touring with the Outlaws and real heavily. And I just said, man, I'm not going to do this anymore. And I started writing a solo record. And that was my first one, Skeletons in the Closet. And I just took a whole different attitude because, you know, we used to have a joke when we would go down to Music Row to write. It would be, what are we going to rhyme with love today? And I didn't want to do that anymore.
Yeah.
I wanted to write about things that meant something in my life and things that I saw going on around me. Henry Paul used to call me the social commentator of songwriters, you know. It's just expanded. I write a lot about my life. As a matter of fact, in 2018, a woman wrote a big review. She said, "The trouble with Billy Crane is he I can't remember exactly how she put it, but the trouble with Billy Crane is it seems all he wants to do is write about things important to him now." It's like, well, what do you think?
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
That's exactly right. I guess she was wanting me to write hit songs or something, you know. Never befuddles me what you'll get in a review, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, you were talking about when you were in Nashville and you were like, okay, we're going to write a song. We don't know what, you know. I was in a similar situation where I was working for a music library. And, you know, you'd show up on the day, you know, you had a few guitars in your hands and you're like, okay, today's going to be bluegrass. Today's
yeah.
Today's going to be jazz. Today's going to be, you know, and it was all like, you just had to go in with a blank slate and just say, okay, now this is what they, and it was very strange. I mean, it made me a better player and it made me come up with stuff on the spot, but it wasn't, I don't think it was anything with, you know, a whole lot of meaning, you know, not like what you ended up doing with your solo stuff, which is, you know, yeah, you're speaking from your heart now. That's funny.
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, there's so many great things to write about. I write about I really wrote a lot. Each record had a concept to it, and what I would do, like my third one, Creole Shoes. I had just been down to Haiti after that big earthquake,
mm-hmm.
and I wrote a lot of the songs were about experiences down in Haiti that I had, and what I did was took all proceeds, or most proceeds, I would recoup what I would put into the CD, and then the money went back. I bought a sound system. There was a church we were working through, and their sound equipment was just trashed, and we bought them a whole new sound system. And then I did a record called Hard Places, because I having adopted kids, they came from really, really bad situations. And so there's a place called Papillon Center up here. And they work with kids that have been through really bad situations.
Mm-hmm.
And the money from that all went to them. And so it's been a process with each record, just donate the money to it, to whatever situation I'm working. And so it helps me each time to have a different concept kind of too, so to write songs about different things. And it's really my songwriting has excelled. People are telling me that I'm writing the best songs of my life now, and which I don't know if that's true. I'm a firm believer in Jesus Christ, and I know the Holy Spirit's behind a lot of them. It's been great. It really has. And like you said, that's very cool. You're telling that story about the blue doing bluegrass and then jazz. You have to put it on a different hat, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
As they call it, and it really enlarges your musical experience.
Oh yeah,
like that.
Oh yeah, it completely changed who I was as far as a player, and gave me a deeper appreciation for the music that I was trying to interpret.
I think we as guitar players get in our little box, you know, our safe little box, yeah, and don't want to get out of it.
Yeah, it's true. It really is true. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's amazing because, you know, I'm looking at, you know, some of the songs that you've been a co-writer on and for who, and it's, and you've had that same thing happen where you were the chameleon in the room, you know?
Yes.
I mean, you know, you're on the Dixie Chicks. You co-wrote Let Her Rip, which was, that was a pretty big tune for them.
That was huge.
Yeah.
You know, I'll give you a funny story about that. It was supposed to be their fifth single, and it was, we're getting ready to release it, and they had just finished recording their second album, and that movie with Julia Roberts, Ready to Run, was Runaway Bride, was getting ready to come out.
Mm-hmm.
So right at the last minute, they pulled that from being a single because the head of A&R over there said, if we release Let Her Rip as a single, it's going to chart too long, and it's going to hold, it's really going to mess up the release of the second album. And I'm going, wait a minute, you're telling me you got this song you know is going to be a huge hit song and you're not going to release it? They did give me a single on the next act on a different group, but the token, but it still sold so much. I mean, I still get money for it. It's
that's great.
It done well. I was very thankful for getting that cut, because I didn't know who Dixie Chicks were when they first came to town.
Well, yeah, yeah.
And ended up working on the wreck and playing guitar on it too. So,
oh wow, okay.
Yeah, I played in their band actually for a little bit too.
Really, you were touring with them, huh?
Yeah, yeah. They were on the radio tour. We went out and did six or seven shows across the country. So.
Yeah, they exploded there for a while, man.
They did.
They really did. And, you know, you work with one of my all-time favorite, I don't know what you call them, country rock, Pogo.
Yes, yeah. Rusty Young.
Oh, man.
They were, you know, the first time I saw them was in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
and they played at Vanderbilt University, and they blew me, we were watching, and blew our mind. Rusty picked up, do you remember when he used to pick up his chair he was sitting in?
Mm-hmm.
He would use it for a slide, and he would play a steel with it, man. And I was just blown away. And
they were the anti-Eagles.
They were the anti-Eagles, totally. They're highly underrated, but I knew Rusty for years and wrote with him, and they were a great band. And in 1989 we had that comeback hit for them, I Call It Love, that went one all number one all around the world and stuff. It was a great song.
Yeah. So let me talk to you about your guitar playing. Actually, one quick thing, just going back to your brother for a second.
Yeah.
Now I know you've got his Les Paul, right?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Now, when he was with the band, was he on the track Trudy?
Yes. Okay. No. Trudy was on Fire on the Mountain. That was the one record right before he came on. Okay. I think that was Barry Barnes.
Okay. I was just wondering. That's one of my all-time CDB band, tracks ever.
Yeah, me too. When I was playing with the CDB Revival band, we were playing that every night. It was really cool.
Great tune.
I saw Tommy play it many a night.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I saw them. Oh, man. I saw them at the height of their powers well, I was still living in New York. I saw them at a place called the Nassau Coliseum.
Oh, yeah. We put open the show with the Henry Paul Band.
You know what? Maybe, was that the...
Was that the one when they broke all the windows out?
No. This was right as Devil Went Down to Georgia was like hitting number one.
Right, yeah. That it was, what, 1980 or 79?
No, that's 78, 79, yeah.
Yeah, we did a show with them because we were just starting to break, and it sold out, and the people outside waiting to get in got mad and busted out all the windows and just came on in.
You know what? I do remember that now, yes.
And we were the opening act on that show, yeah, and man, that was a great show.
Oh, it was amazing. It was, I mean, just, you know, that, and it was such a great time. And especially where I was growing up, because, and this is what I loved about where I grew up on. I grew up on Long Island, and
my father's place.
Yeah, oh man, the Village of Old Roslyn, Epi,
yes.
Good old Epi Epstein.
Epi. God, oh, name man. I hadn't heard in a long time.
It was such a great time because, you know, we had radio stations that were playing in a set. You could hear, you know, Henry Paul, CDB, Judas Priest, AC/DC, Pat Metheny, and, you know, I don't know, the Police. You know, it was like, and it wasn't weird, and nobody was put in a box. It was just this. Just this beautiful thing that it was all just music. It wasn't like, oh well, you know. You know, it's funny. It's not like that now. Everything is so compartmentalized. And
yeah,
back then, it really wasn't. And it really lended to my musical tastes really being broadened as a young person. You know,
me too. Because there was a lot of, like, when I heard the Police the first time, I was like, wow, man, that's different, and I can incorporate and steal licks from them, you know, and it was Album Oriented Radio, AOR Radio.
Yeah.
And that was, I thought it was the best, the best in music. It wasn't necessarily just top 40, but it was just all across the board.
Yeah.
And you don't hear that anymore.
No, you don't. Maybe, you know, some college radio, but, you know, it was, we had a radio station on Long Island called WLIR.
And yes.
Matter of fact, they broadcasted that CDB show from the Coliseum on the radio. And while I was at the show, I had my dad record it for me while so sad happened.
Oh, that's so cool. There's still, I've got a recording of that somewhere.
Oh, wow.
In my stack. And we went to the station that day. That was my first radio interview. We were just starting to tour with the Henry Paul Band. Mm-hmm. And I was so excited because I got to ride the limo.
Wow, that's amazing. That is amazing.
But I've got that gold top that, you know, that Tommy always played.
Yeah.
I just had it out at Christmas Eve at our family Christmas party. And it's funny, Tommy, you know, always sweat. Man, there was always a huge puddle around him and Charlie. They were so intense as a guitar player. And everything he touched would turn the finish to green and mm-hmm. turn, you know, all the
hardware.
Hardware on it to green too. Yeah, you know, it looks like it's actually a 57 reissue that he bought in 81, and it looks like a 57. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's I call that well loved.
It is well loved. I tell you what, I've got a Frankenstrat of his that his wife bought for him years ago, and I pull it out. His Stratocaster that he played Drinking My Baby Goodbye on, and the serial number on it, it's a 53, and the serial number is 970.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, it is cool. I've got, when he passed away, he left his guitars to me. I've got guitars in every closet in the house. My wife's like, what are you going to do with these? I said, that's your inheritance.
Yeah.
Don't ever gripe about those guitars because they will bring you a lot of money.
That's right. That's right. So let's talk about your tone for a second, your playing. What on the new single, what are you using on there? Because that guitar work in the beginning is fantastic.
You know what? I'm actually using I'm using my 60 Les Paul Special, the double cutty way.
Okay.
Yeah, that red one I played. Yeah. I played actually at the Nassau Coliseum.
Mm-hmm.
I bought it in 1974 at O'Donnell Music Center here in Nashville for $350 and on layaway. I couldn't afford it. It took me 2 years to buy it. But I bought it, and I've had it since then. And I ran it, and I actually used one of those little Spark positive grids. I bought one just to practice with, and I went, I'm going to try recording with this thing, and ran it. You know, it's got those two little 6-inch speakers in there. Clapped a little mic on there, and it got a pretty cool tone. I'm not big on digital amps, mm-hmm. but it's not bad. I'm a tube guy. I've always been a tube guy,
mm-hmm.
but it got a different tone. So you know, I went with that.
That's cool. And was that, you know, was that highly worked out, that piece in the beginning, or was that kind of off the cuff for you?
That was off the cuff. It came at the end when I was recording.
Wow.
I was going, you know, I wanted to get something like Thunderstruck.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And that riff.
Yeah, now that you mention it, yeah.
Of course, like I said, I can't do pull-offs good, so I wasn't holding my hand up in the air. I thought the riff, and it fell into place real good because I wanted to get that power across from the song.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it's an attention getter, so folks go, okay, I got to listen to this song now. Let's hear what's going on, without a doubt. So I hear that you also played Dwayne's LP?
Dwayne Allman's, back in when I was playing with Bobby Whitlock. For those of you who don't know, that Bobby Whitlock was the keyboard player in Derek and the Dominoes.
Mm-hmm.
And then with, you know, all this, and with Delaney and Bonnie and friends and so many others. And we were playing a show in Nashville at the Exit Inn, and remember the Dixie Dregs?
Oh, yeah.
Steve Morse
and Rod Morgenstern, and oh my God.
Andy, what a band.
Andy West, goodness gracious.
God, they were just anomalies, you know, in the Southern rock scene.
Oh, yeah.
We'd open these shows for him. I'm like, who is this guy? Way before Eddie Van Halen, man, we were opening a show with Twiggs Linden, who was the Allman Brothers Band road manager back in when Dwayne was alive.
That's right. Twiggs approved.
Yeah. Twiggs was, we were cool. We were doing sound check, and Twiggs, I was such a huge Dwayne Allman protege. You know, grew up watching him play and got to see him many times. And I was playing we were playing Why's Love Got to Be So Sad, you know, and I was doing all these Dwayne licks. Twiggs came up afterwards and handed me this Tobacco Sunburst Les Paul, and he said, would you like to play this during the show? And I flipped it over, and on the back of it, it had Dwayne written, and the frets had been refretted. And I just flipped. I was like, wow, are you kidding me?
Wow.
And then a couple of years ago, I got to, I was down playing in Macon and went to the Big House, and Big John, the guy, I think it's his name, or Jim, that runs it, said, would you like to play the first guitar that Dwayne ever owned? And he took me in the room, and he said, normally I won't let anybody play this, but he had a red Les Paul Jr.
Mm-hmm.
in there, man. And it, wow, you're talking about vibes.
Yeah.
And just recently, somebody gave me one of Dwayne's slide bottles, one of his Corsair bottles. I've got, I've been using it a little bit. I'm too afraid I'll drop it. So.
I don't blame you. Yeah. So, I mean, so you did experience that moment of mojo, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because sometimes, I mean, it's just a mind blower to me. Like, you know, I got to play Bloomfield's Telecaster, the one that he played at the folk festival,
man.
when Dylan killed folk.
Yeah,
you know,
you're right.
And that guitar, I mean, it was crazy. I mean, granted, it was really broken in, of course. You know, I mean, it's a however old it was when I played it. But man, I could feel it vibrated different. It felt different. It was just a different. I mean, I've got plenty of Telecasters around here, but man, it was its own thing.
You're right. You know, when they're broken in by somebody, they just have this thing about it. It's like Tommy's Gold Top. Another one I got to play for a while on the road, even. Was Steve Gaines' Stratocaster that actually went through the plane crash.
Oh, my goodness.
And man, oh, man, that guitar, it could just sing. And it was, man, it was amazing. Mm. And you're right about that. They just had this mojo on it, yeah. You know. It's just,
Yeah.
I urge anybody out there, if you ever get a chance, to pick up somebody's broken in guitar, you know. Everybody always says, how do you get that tone, you know?
yeah, it's true. It's, you know, I just, you know,
how do you get to play Bloomfield's guitar?
I was at a guitar show, and it was being auctioned off.
Oh, man.
And I walked over, and you know, I and the starting bid, I think the starting bid was $35,000 starting bid. And I said,
you didn't come home with it.
No, I sure didn't. I said to the gentleman there, I said, can you give me a little more information here? I'm interested. He's like, oh, you are. And he unlocked the case, the glass case. He took it out. He goes, would you like to plug it in and sit down with it for a while? I go, yes, oh. Yes, I would.
Yes, I would. A while. Come back in a couple hours.
So yeah, I sat down with it and he left me alone. He just walked away.
Wow.
And I was just like, this is the craziest thing that's ever happened. But I think he thought I was some sort of high roller that I was going to start bidding, you know, later on when the auction started. And so I guess everybody else was getting to try it. I mean, we were at another auction, me and one of my contributors here, Rob Wengler. We went and he got to play Jack Bruce's bass.
Oh, wow.
Which was crazy. And once again, another one of those things. And he's got a replica of that bass, but he said it was a completely different feel, you know? And, you know, there's something about that vibration that happens in that player. You know, once again, we were talking about the meat on metal on wood. You know, that DNA gets in there. And
absolutely.
It just, you know, it just happens. It's just there, you know.
It's absolutely, when I pick up Tommy's Crane guitars,
yeah,
I actually take on Tommy Crane. I start playing like him. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's just weird.
Yeah.
You know? When I was playing with Charlie, before Charlie died, I got that feeling that Tommy had every night when they were on stage, you know. Charlie Daniels was an amazing man.
Yeah. He was one of those first guys that I was around, like Roy Clark, in that, you know, he played the fiddle, he played electric guitar, he played acoustic guitar.
Right.
You know, I mean, it was just like, okay, so I don't have to do just one thing. I can do a bunch of things. That's how I look when I saw Charlie Daniels and Roy Clark and folks like that. I was like, okay, I don't have to be boxed in, you know. It was very very inspiring. He was a very inspiring guy.
Yeah, Charlie, yeah, he was I don't know if you ever heard what it's very little known, and they didn't promote it well, but we did a blues record called Songs in the Key of E. It came out in right before he died in 2018. It's a very interesting record. All the songs are in the key of E, but they're all swampy, bluesy songs.
Cool.
And it's called The Boll Weevils. And they finally have re-released it under The Boll Weevils featuring Charlie Daniels. And great record. We were doing this one song called Mudcat, and he goes, "Oh man, and he really needs a dober on this." He goes, "Roger, go upstairs and grab the national." And Roger puts this national in my hand, and I said, "Oh, Al, where'd you get this?" He goes, "Oh, Ronnie Van Zant gave that to him." Jeez Louise.
More mojo.
Boy, and it had the mojo. Man, oh man, it's got this tone on there that's just so good. It's... And with Charlie was just such a delight to work with, man. I mean, he's an amazing guy. I really miss him.
Yeah. Wow, that's incredible. Would you do us the honor of telling your Alan Collins story?
All right, Alan. Alan and I met at the 1979 Volunteer Jam in Nashville.
Uh-huh.
And it's the year it was Henry Paul was playing and Dickie Betts was there. And it was the year Skinner played for the first time since the plane crash. They honored Ronnie and just put a microphone out there with his hat on it, I remember.
Yeah.
And Alan saw me play and came up and just immediately took to me, and we became really great friends. Anytime I would play somewhere in the South around Jacksonville, he would show up, and we would hang out. And we ended up being opening for them on the Anytime, Anyplace tour when they released that first Roger Collins record.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a lot of shows with them, and just all over the country. And I used to go out and play Freebird with them every night. And so we were playing in Columbus, Ohio, and we had a day off, and our guitar player, David Feaster, the Florida Cannonball, decided to go out with a road crew, and we were like, "Don't go out with a Roger Collins road crew. They were all crazy." So, of course, what's he do? He goes out, and he gets put in jail. He gets in an altercation and gets in jail, and so we get him out, and the next day we're down at having band dinner. Both bands are in there eating, and Alan comes busting in the door, big old grin on his face, wild hair, looks at Feaster and goes, "What kind of bird doesn't fly?" He said, "A jailbird." And then he runs across the room and plops himself right down in my lap, puts his big old arms around me and gives me a kiss on the cheek, and then bit the lobe of my ear as hard as he could. And I thought I've got even little teeth marks in my lower right earlobe where he bit me. And then he just let go and started laughing and took off out the door again.
I love that.
And there was always something with those guys, man. There was the first night I ended up playing Freebird was on them, was in Lubbock, Texas, and tour just started, and something had upset Alan during the set, and on the very next to last number, remember he used to play that double cutaway Les Paul. Mm-hmm. That he really liked. I got mad and what's the guy, guitar player from The Who, my memory.
Pete
Townsend. And cracked, he smashed it on his amp and broke the neck of it and just took off. And Gary was like, "Well, we got to have another guitar player. We can't do Freebird, you know?" And I said, "I'll come up there and do it. I knew the chords to it." So they found Alan, and they couldn't find him anywhere. They were packing up to leave. They found him about an hour and a half sitting in an ice cream shop in the middle of a Lubbock, having a big, great, big ice cream cone, and just sitting there smiling like nothing had ever happened. That's just a day's work for those guys.
Man, that would be, you know, there'd be a good movie, biopic would be Lynyrd Skynyrd. That would be.
Absolutely.
That'd be really good.
Someone told me a story the other day of a picture, I guess, of them in Germany, and they'd had a drunken brawl, and I guess Alan had cut Gary's hands with a broken bottle or something, and his hands were all bandaged up in this picture. And that's like only in Skynyrd, you know.
Oh yeah, they were one of those bands growing up too. I mean, you know, there were some radio stations that we used to call them. This one radio station, I won't mention them because they're still around, but we would call them the Skynyrd, Zeppelin, Pink Floyd on the Every Hour on the Hour station.
That's it. It still is, too.
It still is, yes.
Be on classic rock, man. I tell you what. That was a great band, though, too, man.
Oh, yeah.
Gee whiz. Alan was a powerhouse guitar player.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Steve Gaines, man. And I got to meet Ed King right before he died. Mm-hmm. And play for Sweet Home Alabama. He looked at me and goes, "This key, you know this is in the key of G, don't you?" I mean, key of D, I think it was. I can't remember what this was. Like, oh, okay. But it was cool meeting him.
That is great. That is great. Wow, you have seen so much and done so much, and I'm just in awe of it all. It's just, you... Have you ever thought about writing a book?
You know, I really haven't. I've got partially written stuff. Really, I started writing this book called Tales of Rooster Boy because I guess I can say this on YouTube. Our next door bro over here had a kid in his 20s, man, and we called him Rooster Boy. He was always doing these really crazy things over there in the woods, the haunted woods, I like to call them. And I was writing these short stories on Facebook, and everybody was going nuts, going, "You need to write a book." And I've been thinking about it lately, about writing. I got so much good stuff. There's some bad stuff, but there's a lot of good stuff. I think it would be interesting to write. You know what I really regret, Mark, is why didn't I carry a camera with me everywhere? Because, man, I could have had so many great pictures.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But maybe it's better that you didn't.
Yeah, it probably is. There's a few nights I'm glad I didn't wear a camera.
Oh, man, when I was a touring musician, I'm so glad there weren't cell phones.
Me too, man. Do you remember... You used to be able to go to sound check. There was nobody there.
Right.
You go to the hotel. There was nobody there. You got on the bus. Nobody knew where you were. Now you walk into sound check. You got your cowboy boots on. You got your swim trunks on, and you know your Ethel hat. And the place is half full already because everybody knows what time sound check is.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not right.
No, they're not. They're not allowing any of the mystique.
No,
man. Thank you so much for doing this with me today.
Man, it is an honor, Mark. Thank you so much for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to talk with you. Absolutely. Thank you so much for what you do.
Oh, absolutely. Will you promise me one thing though? Will you?
Yes, sir.
Will you come back when Hoodie comes out?
Yes, I will. And that is definitely a promise. I would love to.
I would love that. That'd be great. I'll let Steve know that we talked about that. And I would love that to happen.
Okay. And thank you so much. And you have a great day.
That's great. Hey, we're going to go out on a tune. We went out. We came in on Something Worth Fighting For. You want to pick a tune off of Village to go out on?
Yeah.
What do you want to do?
Honeycomb is my favorite.
All right. That's my favorite, too.
I'll give you a quick story. Honeycomb's a true story. So there's a little bit of embellishment to it. But if you listen to that first verse, that is a true story.
Okay. I love it. Okay, cool. Well, that's the tune we're going to go out on then.
All right, man.
All right. We're going to sign off right here, but you hold on 1 second.
Okay.
All right.
Guitar Radio Show on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher Radio, GuitarRadioShow.com, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Find Guitar Radio Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And remember, if you like the artists you hear on Guitar Radio Show, don't just stream their music, buy it.